my job was to receive bodies at night from the hospital. When anyone died at night, after 5 o'clock and until 8 o'clock the next morning, they died in the hospital, then I would have to receive the body. And Max and I, we lived together in that morgue room for 3 years.
Hello and welcome to A Pixie from Kilmarnock, a program about the people, places, and the history of the Northern Neck of Virginia. I'm your host, Pixie E. Curry. Dr. James E.C. Norris's journey is a worldwide adventure that started in the rural segregated Northern Neck of Virginia. He attended a school that was named after his father, Dr. Morgan E. Norris, himself a physician who had to establish himself in an already difficult occupation. Made even more difficult because of lack of resources in a small, rural southern town. But we're also just another place where Jim Crow made its presence known. Dr. Norris, the son, wrote a book about his father, who was also an activist, whose determined voice was heard not only on the Northern Neck, but in the capital of the Commonwealth, demanding the assurance that the Black community receive proper medical care and proper resources for in education. Dr. Norris continued the tradition his father started, observing a need, then addressing that need with resolve to eliminate it. As a young man, then husband, then father, he persevered through the war in Southeast Asia and in the continued war against Jim Crow on American soil. He is a United States Naval veteran. He was chief of surgery at the Veteran Administration Hospital, Tuskegee, Alabama. He is a board-certified general surgeon and established his practice as a plastic surgeon in New York City. Now retired, Dr. James E.C. Norris's journey still continues as he researches for material for his second book and still traveling at the tender age of 90. This is part two of Dr. Norris's story. How did you feel attending a school that was named after your father?
Well, I had no special feelings about that, and I'll tell you why. Because we were brought up not to feel that we had any special privilege or anything, and we went to the school every day just as other students did, and we expect to be treated as the other students, and we were expected by the teachers to behave as the other students. And if we didn't behave, then they came down on us just like they did the other students. When I say us, I'm talking about the Norris children and particularly myself. And I was actually expelled from the school when I was in the sixth grade. Miss Bird sent me home and and told me that if I didn't hurry up and leave, that she'd give me a whipping, too. So I hurried up and left. But overall, no special treatment and no special feeling about it. Of course, my dad, I was always proud to see him when he came by to visit the school, which he came to give talks and so forth occasionally. But other than that, I didn't feel anything special about it.
You fought or served, and one of your stations was in Vietnam?
Yes. Let me tell you about that. I was actually in the Navy. Tell you, it's a very interesting story about that. See, I was the same age as your uncle, Joe Carey. He and I, we didn't know each other very well, except we see each other at church, but that was about it. But I remember so vividly that he got drafted for the Korean War. And he went off to the Korean War, and I was about to be drafted too, but I was in a pre-medical program, and I was studying to become a doctor. And if you were in a pre-medical program, then you were permitted to have a deferral until you completed your medical training, but you had to take an examination. They just didn't give you a deferral. So I took the examination, and I passed the examination. And I was deferred from the Korean War. Okay, but that doesn't mean that I wasn't eligible for the draft. The Korean War ended, I think, in 1951. We had no further concern about the draft unless there was an increase in mobilization of the troops. Things went along very well until I was actually, fast forward now, about 13 years. I was 34 years old, and I got a call from Mr. Lloyd Hubbard. Mr. Lloyd Hubbard was head of the draft board, and he says, Jimmy, he says, we've got to draft you. He says, there's no way we can get around it. I said, well, Mr. Hubbard, if I have to go, incidentally, what had happened was the Vietnam War had heated up. That's what had happened. So we'd gotten very much involved in the Vietnam War. This was 1966, and so they were mobilizing troops and sending more and more troops to Vietnam, and they needed more men. And those guys who were deferred for the Korean War for whatever reason, fellows that had to be drafted up first. So I was drafted. Mr. Hubbard said to me, now, Jimmy, I'm going to have to issue this draft order very soon. I can give you one up on this. If you sign up for one of the branches of the service, whichever branch of the service that you'd like, you can go ahead and sign up for that, and then they'll take care of the situation. Otherwise, I'm going to draft you for the Army. Well, I was already a surgeon, and I was preparing to take my examinations for the boards in surgery, I decided that I would really like to serve in the Air Force. The Air Force was the most desired branch of service that particularly doctors wanted. So I contacted the Air Force. They call the Bureau of Personnel in Washington, D.C. I contacted the Bureau of Personnel, and they said that they weren't taking any more people in the Air Force and that I would have to look at one of the other branches. So I contacted the Bureau of Personnel for the Navy, and the Navy was very receptive. They said, sure, if you'd like to sign up. So I've forgotten exactly how I did it, but I signed up for the U.S. Navy and sent a copy of my papers to Mr. Hubbard to satisfy the draft board in Lancaster County. And I entered the United States Navy January 1967, and I was 34 and a half years old. So that's how I ended up in the service. And then once I got in the service, they have a sheet. It's called the Dream Sheet. Now, you have to understand what this means, and only people in the military really understand what it means. It's a sheet that you list the three preferred locations to which you would like to be assigned. Well, I had met a young lady in Japan on one of my travels to Japan, and I was very interested in getting to the Far East. So I put down all three preferences were the Far East. Well, guess what? I got sent back to New York, where I'd been for the past 4 years. So I stayed in New York. I was assigned to the United States Naval Hospital in St. Albans, New York, and I was a surgeon there, and I was on the staff. The little Japanese girl that I was interested in, I enticed her to come to the U.S., and she came, and I also enticed her to marry me, which she agreed to. We had a honeymoon baby, and 9 months later, my son came, and I was still at the Naval Hospital. I had about, I think, 4 or 5 months left in the Navy. Incidentally, I have to digress to tell you that when you were drafted to serve in during the Vietnam War, your draft period was for two years, and I had only about 5 months left. I got called from the captain of the Naval Medical Corps at the Naval Hospital one day, and he said, come down to my office, I have some not-so-good news for you. And I thought, my God, what's happened to my mother? My mother was sick, so that's what the first thing I thought about. And I went down to his office, and he says, Jim, he says, we have to send you to Vietnam. We got orders to send you to Vietnam. And I was just flabbergasted. Jesus, I only had about 5 months in the service. Why in the hell they were sending me to Vietnam? But what happened was the intelligence led the American armed forces to believe that they were going to have another Tet-like offensive. If you're familiar with the Vietnam War, they had the first Tet offensive, I think it was in January of 1967, and it was a very bitter fight between the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong versus the United States armed forces. Of course, we prevailed. When I say we, I'm talking about the United States armed forces prevailed, but it was a very costly fight, and they thought they were going to have another attack like that. So they mobilized a whole bunch of us troops and sent us over there expecting another attack. It didn't happen, but I had some very interesting experiences in Vietnam, and I treated a number of casualties, mainly young men who had been shot in the field, who had been hurt by explosives. Most of them were injured by shrapnel. When an explosive device blew up, it would be small metal fragments, which would hit them, called shrapnel, and they would come in with holes all over their body sometimes. Of course, some of them didn't survive. I didn't have many guys who didn't survive. Once they got there, we pretty much made sure they lived. We operated on them, and after we operated on them in Vietnam, the next day we evacuated them immediately to the Naval Hospital in Japan. We had a Naval Hospital in Yokohama, Japan, that we sent them to. And so I was over in Vietnam until December of 1968, and I came back just about Christmas time to be discharged, and I was discharged in January of 1969. I had a great experience in Vietnam. I have a good friend that I met. I didn't know him before I was in Vietnam. He's a doctor, too, an orthopedic surgeon. And he and I became great friends, and it's kind of interesting because he was a southern boy, a white boy, and I'm a southern boy, a colored boy. And guess what we were arguing about every day? He was a proponent of George Wallace. and I was of course, anti-George Wallace. But I brought him around, and he and I got to be good friends, and we are very close friends to this day. So that was the one good thing, experience that came out of Vietnam. Plus, it was great to be part of the service, and although I did not, I have to tell you, I was very informed about the Vietnam War. I read a lot of books about the war before I went over there, and I felt that really the country had made a big mistake to get into the war. And that's another thing my friend from Texas and I used to argue, because he felt we should be there, and I told him we didn't have any justifiable reason to be in Vietnam. There was no reason we should be there. But I wasn't so against the war that I would refuse to serve, because I'm an American citizen, and I've benefited from many benefits. for many advantages of living in this country. And one of the obligations you have as a citizen is to serve in the military when you're called on. So I didn't even think of draft dodging or any kind of maneuvers to avoid the draft like some of our presidents did. So that's my experience in Vietnam.
You're talking about Uncle Joe. My dad also served in the Korean police action. It's how I always described it. When my father was serving, they had just integrated the military, but there was a lot of segregation and discrimination that was still occurring. Did you see any of that happening while you were in Vietnam?
I'm going to tell you, it was it was felt by American blacks that the blacks were disproportionately represented in the armed forces, particularly at the lower level in Vietnam. And that was because of the lack of opportunity. So many young blacks didn't have wherewithal and also the understanding of how to maneuver to avoid the draft, where a lot of white fellows did. When it comes around to as far as discrimination against blacks, first, let me tell you my own experience as an officer in the Navy. I never encountered a single episode of where I felt I was discriminated against. When I was at the U.S. Naval Hospital, there were two surgeons. There was a career surgeon named Lowell Davis. Dr. Davis was he was a full commander. He was over me, but I was a lieutenant commander. I was one rank below him. He was a very refined gentleman, and never once did he say he encountered any discrimination, nor did I, and nor in my treatment by the other doctors, nor in my advancement. So personally, I encountered no discrimination. As far as the black servicemen I interacted with, this issue never really came up, never was discussed. So I really can't comment on that. Many experiences, particularly around discrimination, are very personal, and so there are other people who may have had some episode, some incident that where they felt it was discriminatory. But I never once encountered any problem at all.
You got into the field of reconstructive surgery because of the veterans that were at the Tuskegee Veterans Hospital?
Yes, the Tuskegee Veterans Hospital. Let me tell you what happened. I was a fully trained surgeon. I started out as a family doctor, and I went to Florida. And first, I practiced with my dad for about 6 months. My dad and I got along okay. It wasn't that we didn't get along. It was just that my dad's way of practice was kind of alien to me. And it was a generation thing more than anything else, and it was really a traumatic separation. But I felt I would really want to be on my own, and so I went to Florida and I did general practice. Then in Florida, I did run into episodes of discrimination in Florida against black patients, and I was very offended by that, and I decided I would go back and learn surgery and come back to Florida and do surgery. Here's what happened. I left Florida after about almost 4 years, and I went to New York to study general surgery, not plastic surgery now, general surgery. And that is, you operate on the abdomen and hernias and gallbladders and stomach ulcers and that kind of thing. And we even did amputations, of course. And then in my training at that time, which was in the 60s, general surgeons often did orthopedic surgery too. We did fractures, and I used to do hip fractures and so forth. So I was very well trained as a surgeon, but then I got drafted. I didn't expect I was going to get drafted. I had no inkling that I was going to get drafted until Mr. Hubbard called me. And so when I was drafted, then I went over and served in Vietnam. And there I was doing only surgical procedures, mainly on the soldiers who had gunshot wounds to the abdomen. I had one boy who was shot in his rear end. It's a very interesting case. I'll tell you about that because it's so interesting about how the war was. This boy was shot in his rear end. The bullet entered just to about 2 inches or 3 inches to the right or left of his anus. I've forgotten, but it was near his anus. The bullet went through his abdomen, through his diaphragm, through his lung, and lodged in his chest. So we had to operate on him. He had lots of holes in his intestines. I sewed up all the holes. I found the area where the diaphragm had been pierced. I repaired that. Then we had to open his chest and had to drain his chest so that he wouldn't get an infection. And, of course, he was sent to Japan the next day. But I went to see him, and I said, Private, this was the next morning after the surgery, of course. He was awake, and he was doing pretty good. And I said, Private, I said, what were you doing, running from the Vietnamese? I said, you got shot in your rear end. And he said, no, sir. I wasn't running, sir. He said, we had them surrounded, and we were wiping them out, sir. But they came up behind us and attacked us from the rear as we were encircling this group of Vietnamese soldiers. And that's how I got shot. I'll tell you what the Vietnamese did. They were very clever. They would have what they call spider traps. Now, I'll tell you what a spider trap is. They would dig holes. Most of the Vietnamese men were of a small stature. They were only like maybe 5 feet or so in height. Many of them were. They would dig a hole, and they would crawl in the hole, and then they would cover the hole with a platform, some type of platform, and leaves and so forth, so that a soldier could walk over that and not even realize that he was walking over somebody who was hiding in a little hole in the ground. And then they would very cleverly peek out that little crack or something they had devised, and then they would take a shot at the guy from behind. That was one of the ways they attacked our soldiers. And the other way was it was jungle fighting. You didn't, very thick jungle, you could hardly see sometimes where you were in the jungle. So you might have a group of enemy soldiers surrounded, but at the same time, there could be enemy pockets of enemy soldiers coming up behind you. So that's what happened to him. It was a very vicious war. That's how this poor guy got shot. Most of the fellows who were shot were shot head on. There were lots of fellows who got shot in the chest and so forth, and by shot by snipers too. So I had this tremendous battle experience. Plus, I operated on a lot of the men who were brought to us from Vietnam when I was at the U.S. Naval Hospital. So I had a tremendous amount of surgical experience. I decided that when I got out of the Navy, I was married, I had a child, and I decided I would go to Florida. Well, I went to Florida to practice, and every town I visited in Florida, and we are talking now in 1969, every doctor I visited, black doctor I visited, told me that if I came back to Florida, that I would have to do general practice. And they said, don't think you're going to come here and be a surgeon, because nobody's going to refer patients to you. The white doctors are not going to send you patients. And he said, even a lot of the black doctors won't send patients to you. We don't care how much training you've gotten, how good you are. He says, the fact of the matter is you're going to do general practice again. So I said, well, you know, that doesn't make any sense after all, spending all this time in training. And that was 4 years of training, Miss Curry. And on top of that, I spent 2 years in Vietnam. So I had 6 years of experience as a surgeon. And then to go back to do general practice would be really a step down and would be stupid. So I found there was a vacancy at the Tuskegee VA hospital for someone to run the surgical department. I applied for that, and I got that position. And I went there, and I was really enjoying my work very much. But I kept seeing so many veterans who needed reconstructive surgery that I decided that I would go away and study reconstructive surgery and come back to the VA. After almost 4 years at the VA, 3.5 years to be exact, I left and went into plastic surgery at the University of Michigan. I studied plastic surgery for 2 years, and then I contacted the VA in Alabama, but my wife says, wait a minute, hold on. She says, if you're going back to Alabama, you're going back by yourself, because I am not going to Alabama. And so my wife and I had a long discussion about that, and she said she was definitely not going back to Alabama. She hated being in Alabama. And so I said, well, where would you like to go? And So she says, well, there are only four places I'm interested in: Tokyo, San Francisco, New York, or Paris. I'm not kidding about this. I had a New York license because I'd already practiced in my surgical training in New York. So it was a no-brainer. I came to New York City, and that's how I came to New York and ended up practicing here in New York since 1974.
How many other countries have you traveled?
As far as the countries I've traveled in, my travel has been primarily in Asian countries of Vietnam and Japan. I've spent a number of trips to Vietnam. I did volunteer work over there for 9 years. I would go back and forth to Vietnam. For 7 years, I went there as a volunteer surgeon every year. And I traveled to Vietnam, both north and south, very much. And also, I've traveled all over Japan, but I've not been to other Asian countries. I've never been to Korea. I've never been to Taiwan. I've never been to China. As far as the Americas, I've been to a number of South American countries, most of the countries in South America. I've been to almost all of the Caribbean island countries. The island country I like most of all, you won't believe it, but it's true, is Haiti. Haiti is absolutely a marvelous little country, and despite its chaos there, I've traveled to a number of countries in Europe, and I've traveled to Russia. And of course, my son lives in Finland, so I go back and forth to Finland now. But I've traveled to Denmark, and I've traveled to France, Spain, Turkey, and those countries. Been to Amsterdam. I've traveled they call it the Costa del Sol, which is the southern coast of Spain, having the Sunshine Coast, really. I have traveled there by car. I rented a car and I've driven in Spain. And I communicated and even took directions and everything in Spain, in Spanish, when I was there traveling there. That's the extent of my international experience.
You are listening to A Pixie from Kilmarnock with part two of an interview with Dr. James E.C. Norris, retired plastic surgeon and author of Fight On My Soul. But first, a glimpse into the experiences of the young medical student, Dr. Jimmy, the name that many of the people of Kilmarnock called him when he practiced for a short time with his father.
Personal bring the body on the stretcher and you take the body and put it in an ice box. Yeah, refrigerator. We call them ice boxes, but they were actually refrigerators. And then if the body had to have an autopsy that night over weekends, then we had to assist on the autopsies. But each one of those autopsies was a learning experience, and so it didn't take that much. And the other two jobs were working on the information desk. We didn't have security like they have security now. There was only one security guard for all of the medical school, and the medical students worked as security. I worked on the information desk on weekends, so if anybody wanted information at the medical school, they would come to my desk. But nobody came practically, so I couldn't go anywhere, so it was a great time to study. Also on weekends, we had to punch the clock at night, so I think it was 4 o'clock in the morning. 10 o'clock at night, 4 o'clock in the morning, 8 o'clock the next morning, but just before we went off, we had to go around and punch the clock throughout the whole building to make sure everything was secure. That wasn't much work either. Then the fourth job, I didn't have that very long because taking care of monkeys, this doctor was doing research and he had these monkeys and he wanted the cages cleaned and the monkeys fed. That didn't take much time, but what annoyed me was he didn't tell me that the monkeys had tuberculosis, so I didn't keep that job very long. But anyhow, the dean heard, and I don't know how the dean found out that I had these jobs. He called me in and said he was concerned that I had these jobs, and I said, well, it's not interfering with my studies unless you tell me that it is, but I said, I think I'm doing all right academically. And he said, yes, you're doing fine academically, he says, but I'm just worried about you having so much responsibility. And I wanted you to know that if you need financial help, we'll give you financial help. So I said, well, Dean, I really appreciate that, but right now I think I can handle the jobs. So I didn't ask the school for financial help. That was my experience. And I thought that for the dean to call me in and let me know that, you know, if I needed financial help, the school would help me. I thought it was really magnanimous. It really was. The medical school was connected to the pathology building by a short tunnel. It was only like 100 feet long. And it was connected to the hospital by another tunnel. So you could go from the medical school to the pathology building where I was living to the hospital without even going outside. And it was just a short walk. So to take care of the morgue was not a problem. They let us have our meals. Oh, the pathology department gave me free meals in the hospital dining room. So I didn't have to pay for my meals. I didn't have to go outside to eat. And then on top of that, working at the information desk in the medical school, it was just a short walk from my room in the pathology building to the medical school. So I didn't have any problem with traveling. I didn't even have a car, Miss Carey, until I was a junior in medical school. And the only reason I had a car then was because we had assignments to hospitals which were required driving. Otherwise, I wouldn't have had a car at all in medical school. Because I lived right there in the hospital and in the morgue. The pathology building had a big lecture room, and all of our classes were given in that lecture room. So I would get up in the morning. I kid you not, and I could get up in the morning, and I could just walk across a hallway, and I'd be in the lecture room. So travel was never a problem for me. That makes a big difference in your existence when you have, particularly when you got to juggle several jobs, you know.
The title from Dr. Norris's book about his father is from the poem, My Soul, Be on Thy Guard, written by George Heath in 1781.
My soul, be on thy guard. 10,000 foes arise, and hosts of sin are pressing hard to draw thee from the skies. Oh, watch and fight and pray, the battle ne'er give o'er. Renew it boldly every day, and help divine implore. Ne'er think the victory won, nor once at ease sit down. Thine arduous work will not be done till thou hast got the crown. Fight on, my soul, till death shall bring thee to thy God. He'll take thee at thy parting breath up to his blessed abode.
A synopsis of the book states, the Jim Crow era was one of the most disgraceful and difficult periods in our nation's history. It was a time when every facet of a colored man's life was regulated, from birth to death. Prejudice and discrimination were systemic throughout the nation, but the South encoded these biases and patterns of treatment of an entire segment of the population based on skin color into legislative mandates for nearly a century. Morgan Norris's modus operandi, told through his son in his book, was to forge his vision of a better society through a spirit of cooperativeness and mutual respect that transcended race. The author chronicles the struggles of an indomitable individual in his fight for a more just society, his battles for the control and eradication of disease, and his commitment to the blotting out of illiteracy and ignorance. Fight On My Soul, the book that you wrote about your father, Dr. Morgan E. Norris. What led you to write the book?
I didn't really intend to write a book, Miss Carey. What happened was I was always giving some quotes to my son, particularly, and my wife would hear them. And they say, you have all these quotes from your dad. Why don't you make a, like a little anthology of his sayings to pass on to your son and your grandchildren? And so I thought that would be kind of interesting. So I began writing down some of his quotes, making some notes about what life was with my dad. And then I don't know what prompted me to go to Hampton University. My dad was a trustee at Hampton for 21 years. And I went to Hampton University's archives, and I asked the archivist there, I said, do you have any information on Dr. Morgan E. Norris? I said, he was a trustee here once. And she said, yes, indeed, we have quite a file on Dr. Norris. And she brought out all these papers on my father, and I started reading them, and I was astonished. I mean, things I had never heard about. I had never heard about Ms. DuPont. I knew about Ms. DuPont, but I didn't know about my dad's relationship with Ms. DuPont and how she had helped finance his clinics that my dad had, particularly the orthopedic clinics and so forth, and how she had sent money to help not only the black people in Lancaster and Northumberland counties, but whites as well. I ran across one letter that Ms. DuPont had written my dad, and she says, dear Dr. Norris, thank you so much for your Christmas greetings. She said, also, thank you for sending me the list of people that you distributed the money that I sent. She would send money to my dad to give to the people, and he would write her back and tell her how much he'd given each family and so forth. So she says, would you please tell me which ones were white and which ones were black? I thought that was a kind of a bizarre question, but anyhow. And my dad wrote her a very nice letter back, and he gave her the list of patients who were white and the list of patients who were black. At that time, the population of Lancaster County was about equal with black and white, and the number of people who received contributions from Ms. DuPont on Dad's list was also about equal among the white and black. I found all these interesting things about my dad, and he was quite a remarkable person. I didn't realize he had done so much. I knew about the bus boycott, and I knew about building the school, but I didn't know what he had to go through to build the school, and so I just kept going, digging into his background, and then I decided to go to the archives at Lincoln University, where he was a student, and that was very revealing. And then I decided to go to Howard University, where he was in medical school. As I was researching my dad, there were so many interesting facets of life in the South that I wasn't fully aware of, had no real appreciation. I didn't really appreciate the fact that disease as lethal as tuberculosis. And Miss Carey, you got to understand something. When I was growing up, getting tuberculosis was almost like getting COVID. I mean, if you got tuberculosis, I had one sanatorium in Virginia for blacks. It was up in a place called Piedmont, which is way out in southwestern Virginia, I think. And then they had like three sanatoriums for whites. And I ran across statistics on the number of blacks who were dying from tuberculosis versus the number of whites. And it was affecting blacks to a much greater degree than whites. There's no question about that. And I have a chart showing that in my book. But I ran across all these incidental findings that I had no understanding about. Then I began interviewing people. I interviewed a lady named Miss Alice Dameron. She was quite an outstanding lady. She was once a school teacher. Someone said, well, you have to interview Miss Dameron. And I went to interview Miss Dameron, and she was telling me about my dad and how he treated her and her family, and she was telling me about how life was in the county. And then she told me about the lynching in Northumberland County. Now, I had heard my mother say something once about a lynching in Northumberland County, but we didn't go into a great deal about it. But Miss Dameron actually saw the body hanging from the tree. I mean, I'm sitting there talking to someone who saw a lynched body hanging from the tree. How close do you get to the raw existence that some of these people experience? Very, very enlightening to talk to people like that and find out further facts about what kind of situation my dad was living in and how he had brought my mother from Richmond, Virginia. My mother was a girl and came from Richmond, Virginia, and she was actually fairly well-to-do family, had indoor plumbing, and she had to come down and for about 10 years had to use an outhouse, you know. All of this began to come together as I thought a real interesting story about how life was in the South back during that period. This is the first half of the 20th century, how blacks and whites interacted and the struggles of being black in the South, which were epitomized by what my father went through. And that's how the book came about.
How long did it take you to write?
I spent almost 10 years on that book. And, you know, something about research, very taxing, takes a lot of time. I spent a lot of time in libraries and going around archives. I had a very interesting experience. You've heard of the movie Passing. It's a big thing now. It's up for an Academy Award. All of a sudden, a lot of young blacks have gotten interested in their history, and they have they've made a movie on Passing. Passing it has to do with very light-skinned blacks who actually pass for white if no one knew their background. My father had a sister who married a very light-skinned guy up from Northern Virginia. They lived in Yonkers. They had a daughter. Her name was Alma. Alma became a doctor in 1928, I think. She wanted to go into obstetrics, but because she was a woman, she ran into so much discrimination because of that, not because of her color, but because of her gender, that she ended up becoming a psychiatrist. Alma also was very light-skinned, and if you didn't know it, you'd just think she was white. And so Alma got tired of living in both worlds and decided she was going to just become passed for white. And she left the family. She wrote my dad a letter, and I don't remember it, but one of my sisters told me that she remembered when my dad got the letter from her that she was not going to have anything to do with the family any further. So she left the family. I heard about her when I was growing up. My father never once, in all the time that I spent with him, I spent a lot of time with my dad. He never once brought up anything about this girl. But she became quite a prominent psychiatrist and apparently very well-to-do, and she left a large amount of money to Syracuse University. I tracked her down. I found out where she lived. She lived in Scranton, Pennsylvania. I went to Scranton, Pennsylvania. I interviewed the lawyer who was her attorney and who was subsequently the executor of her estate. He gave me an interview. I have a taped interview from him. And so this kind of thing, it kind of researched it. I just went into all different directions. So much so that I had almost too much material. I had to pare it down to make it a readable book. That's how it came about being a book, really. I just kept finding things out about my dad and my family that I didn't really had no idea about. So I put it together in the form of a book. But I did make one mistake, and a tremendous mistake, and I'll give this point out to anyone who's interested, and particularly interested in writing a book. If you do a lot of research for the book, and you of course, you document your research, which I did. I mean, I have, there's not a fact in that book that I don't have a reference for. But what happened was, putting in the end note, keeping track of the end notes was so arduous and so hard that I decided that I would not put in end notes. The other thing that happened was, in writing the book, was I couldn't find a publisher for the book. After I sent the manuscript out to several people, I sent it out to a big publisher here in New York, and the lady looked at it and said, no, it's not something they'd be interested in publishing. So I self-published the book. What do you mean by self-published? It means that I paid this company to print the book for me. The company, of course, they have editors. They proofread the book. They didn't do any fact-checking. They just proofread it for mistakes in grammar or in English. All the fact-checking I did on my own, and I had people to do fact-checking. I have a lady down in Weems, Virginia. Her name is Ms. Donna Helmuth. She worked in the museum at the Mary Ball Washington Museum and Library for many years. She helped me with a lot of the fact-checking. I also did the fact-checking with my family. And, of course, I also paid some librarians here in New York to review the manuscript for any factual errors and also grammatical errors. So it was a lot of work to put the book together. It was really difficult. If you've never written a book before, then my advice to you is to take some courses in writing. I took one or two courses in writing. They were short courses, but I would have gone off, should have gone off Iowa University. I think they have a course, a one-year course in writing. I should have gone somewhere like that and studied. But I also, on my own, I got, there's a book called The Chicago Manual of Style. I have it right here in my library, and it's about 2 inches thick. Another really important book that I use, a very simple book, is written by a fellow named William Strunk and E.B. White, and it's called The Elements of Style. But I read that, and I read several other books on writing and how to express yourself clearly. So consequently, I spent a lot of time studying in preparation for writing the book as well. So that added to the difficulty. But it was very gratifying, and it's an experience that I wouldn't trade anything for. On that note, thanks. Nice talking to you.
All right, thank you so much.
Okay, okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. In the early days for people who practiced medicine, there was much to be learned. For example, being exposed to new methods to combat diseases. But how to combat the disease of racism? What antidote could be prescribed for that particular illness that spreads so rapidly and widely? What words of comfort could be enough when denial was mixed in with the medicine? This is the year 2022, but how strange that for the things that have changed, there are so many things that remain the same. Contagious diseases, war, stupidity are still residents in our universe. But so are hope, faith, perseverance, and service. The people of the past and of the present who treat our physical bodies are to be commended. The midwives, the rural doctors who once traveled in buggies, cars from house to house, sheltering some patients in their own homes. to personnel of the field hospital erected during wars on foreign soil and here on the home front. The transport of wounded and recovering wounded patients. The sick and the dying, all needing the skill and care of the dedicated and compassionate people who risk all for us. The warriors that paved the way for justices within our communities, those who fight for the sick, the young, the aspiring. These are the attributes we continue while being Black on the Northern Neck. The music by Robert A. Hall. This interview is dedicated to the medics, doctors, nurses, to those who transport the wounded soldiers from the battlefields to the field hospitals, and especially our soldiers. To all those who have taken the Hippocratic Oath, thank you. Thank you for listening.